This morning we have two scripture readings. The first is from Psalm 139, verses 1 through 12. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down, and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from far away. You search out my path and my lying down, and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, O Lord, you know it completely. You hem me in behind and before, and lay your hand upon me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It is so high that I cannot attain it. Where can I go from your spirit? Or where can I flee from your presence? If I ascend to heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there. If I take the wings of the morning and settle at the farthest limits of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light around me become night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light to you. And the second reading is from 1 John chapter 4, some excerpts. Beloved, let us love one another, because love is from God. Everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. Whoever does not love does not know God, for God is love. Beloved, since God loved us so much, we also ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God. If we love one another, God lives in us, and his love is perfected in us. By this we know that we abide in God and God in us, because God has given us of his Spirit. God has been perfected among us in this, that we may have boldness on the day of judgment, because as God is, so are we in this world. There is no fear in love, but perfect love casts out fear. For fear has to do with punishment, and whoever fears has not reached perfection in love. We love because God first loved us. Those who say, I love God, and hate their brothers or sisters are liars. For those who do not love a brother or sister whom they have seen cannot love God whom they have not seen. The commandment we have from God is this: those who love God must love their brothers and sisters also. These are our sacred stories. A few weeks ago, on an otherwise peaceful Saturday morning, I got an anguished call from my boss. Oh, Ashley, she said, Gabriel is dead. It took a minute for her words to even register. Blakely and I were in line at a local breakfast hangout, and my main concern in the moment she called was whether to have pineapple pancakes or something healthier. And then the meaning of her words hit me. She meant that a little boy was dead. An adorable little boy whose mother loved him and lavished attention on him in a way that sometimes, honestly, had made me wonder if I had bathed and kissed on my babies enough. She positively glowed when she carried him in every day. His Down syndrome bothered her not one bit. He was her world, her joy, and now he was gone. Dead at age 2, yanked out of his crib by a desperate father who could not revive him, pounded on by EMTs trying to do the same. That sweet little boy, always so beautifully dressed by loving parents, died on the cold tile floor in his parents' entryway, and no one could stop it. All of us at our school went into action after that. We sat with the family, tried to entertain their other children, cooked and cleaned, and planned a reception. Members of our staff made a video about Gabriel's life and how much he was loved by family, friends, and teachers. We went 60 strong to his funeral and held up his mom in front of his tiny coffin. Something in me broke, though, during the service when the pastor spoke. He left the lectern, went to stand in front of those grieving parents, got right up in that mother's tear-stained face, and told her that she had to accept this death, even rejoice in it, as it was God's will, part of his plan. I left that funeral home feeling sick. My grief for that little boy and his family only exacerbated by my disbelief at what I had heard. It struck me as I drove home and over the next few days that most people in the world are willing to believe in a God who would reach down from his throne, kill a sleeping baby, and then demand that you joyfully worship him anyway. They are willing to believe that because there is security in it. In a world full of fear and danger and grief, for many it feels better to believe in a punitive, law-giving God who acts in ways we cannot possibly understand, but is in charge and does have a plan. It's easier to believe in that than to accept the ambiguity and insecurity of life with no one in charge and no plan at all. I told Tim Wegner about this at our church retreat. He has so much wisdom. Not to put words in his mouth, but he kind of said, "Why does what other people need to believe to feel better bother you so much?" I didn't have a good answer for that. I still don't. But I knew that in here something was wrong. Meanwhile, Laura asked me to be one of the proclaimers during her sabbatical. I was very flattered, but I thought, maybe I just don't have anything left to say. Maybe God and religion and I are done. At that point, it felt like all I could bring to the pulpit would be anger and a long list of what I don't believe. Now, mind you, there's an irony there. In my early 30s, I left the Unitarian Church for this very reason. It felt kind of like all that held UUs together as a people was an eagerness to proclaim what they did not believe in. And now I was turning into the very kind of person who used to irritate me. I went to a friend who's an Episcopal priest. I ranted at her. I mumbled something about how people would rather believe awful things about God than accept ambiguity. She looked at me calmly and said, "Yes, that's true. But can you accept the ambiguity and be religious at the same time? That's the challenge." In other words, if there is no plan and there is no intervention, does that God even matter? Enter now another Episcopal priest, Bishop John Shelby Spong. I've heard him speak many times. One of those times, I ran up and seriously fangirled on him. But that's another story. I've also read many of his books. I thought to myself, I'll make a stack of books. I'll have my Spong books, my Marcus Borg books, my Madeleine L'Engle books, and I will figure out what's bothering me and what I can do about it. So that's what I did. Thing is, I've done that before. I've read these books many times. I know the picture of God they paint. I know how much it's helped me in the past. But maybe I just need reminded. And then I thought, maybe we all need reminded. Especially when things seem hard to accept in this world. Because the idea of God having a plan is harder to let go of than we might want to admit. In his book, A New Christianity for a New World, Bishop Spong has a chapter called Beyond Theism, but Not Beyond God. In it, he speaks about the very model of God that upset me so much at that funeral. The theistic God is a being, supernatural in power, dwelling outside this world and invading the world periodically to accomplish the divine will. The theistic God is always other, always external to the self, always supernatural. The theistic God is also presumed to be the explanation for that which is beyond rational understanding. This celestial Mr. Fix-It, otherwise known as the old man in the nightgown, was exactly what I was in response to. How could the interventionist yet loving God let a little boy die in such a way? It was clear to me that if you held such a view of God, the only answer you could possibly give was that God had a plan that was beyond your understanding. And there is security in that. I get it. But I can't swallow it anymore. So, either I'm an atheist, or there needs to be another way to look at God. And there is. Spong's God is not a being at all, supernatural or otherwise. Let's say that again. Perhaps the God we seek is not a being at all. This God defies definition, needs no creeds. This is a God we experience. This is not a God we define. Spong suggests three ideas to think about. First, consider God as life. One worships this God by living fully, by sharing deeply. Second, consider God as being. Not a being, but being itself. One worships this God by walking into the unknown, by giving your being away, by valuing the being of others more than your own. Perhaps most of all, consider God is love. Or as Bishop Spong puts it, the God who is love is slowly transformed into the love that is God. Boundless, eternal, passing beyond every limit, and calling us to follow this love into every crevice of creation. We journey into this God by being absolved into wasteful, expansive, freely given love. The more we enter and share in this love, the more our lives are open to new possibilities, to the sacredness of otherness, to the limitless transcendence. Ultimately, we discover that our God experience is like swimming in an eternal ocean of love. When I try to describe this reality, words fail me, so I simply utter the word God. That name, however, is no longer for me the name of a being, not even a supernatural being or the supreme being. It is not the title of a miracle worker or a magician or a rescuer. It is rather something as nebulous and yet as real as a holy presence. Now, I won't deny the Bible is pretty theistic in its view of God. Some very monarchical language and lots of intervening on the side of the chosen people. But the Bible writers also hint that they knew another way of thinking about the divine. Keep in mind, the Jews were never allowed to name God. God was beyond definition. Think even what happened when Moses tried to see God's face. He was allowed only to see God's hindquarters. Sounds funny to us, but clearly an acknowledgement that the face of God is not something we can ever really see. The dominant view in the Bible also seems to stress God's otherness or transcendence. However, the writer of Psalm 139 has clearly had an experience of the loving eminence of the divine. You have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. The author of the Epistle of John put the idea so simply and powerfully. Beloved, let us love one another, because love is from God, and everyone who loves is born of God and knows God. This vision of a universe held together by profound love is beautifully realized in the second book of Madeleine L'Engle's Time trilogy that famously begins with A Wrinkle in Time. In The Wind in the Door, Meg Murray can only save her sick little brother and the rest of the universe by naming and then truly loving the very unlovable principal of her high school, Mr. Jenkins. Her angel companion has had to memorize the names of every star in the universe, because to name something is to make it real, to love it into being. Meg must love the very mitochondria in her brother's cells, must even love the evil ekthros, beings filled with hate and nothingness who are trying to destroy the universe. No wonder Madeleine L'Engle was once quoted as saying that the Wrinkle in Time trilogy was the closest she would ever come to explaining her own religion. Her stories clearly point to a God both above and within, a God who is not a controlling being, but very being itself, a God who holds together the unfathomably large universe with the same love that holds together our very cells. This God does not decide to take those we care about. This God cradles us in love when that kind of loss happens. So what can we do at those times when everyone around us seems only interested in the man in the nightgown? What can we do when faced with a theism that hurts us in our very souls? All we can try to do, as Bishop Spong says, is be God bearers, sources of life and love and being in the world. I do not believe that God took baby Gabriel to be in a better place. I do not share her theology, but I reach out to visit with that mama. I talk with her about her child. And day to day, I look up at the stars and I think of the wonder of God. But I also try and remember that God is in each of us. And God is also in the smallest good we try to do in the world.